Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 15th of August. Coming up on the program, reported turmoil in the EFF. I'll discuss our shocking new jobs numbers. Government and private sector detail plans to coordinate efforts to fix South Africa's collapsing infrastructure. The World Health Organization declares Mpox an emergency. Is South Africa ready? And do we need a new medical aid model in South Africa? Now, this is developing as we go to air. Floyd Shivambu has reportedly resigned as the EFF's deputy president. Well-placed leadership sources have told News 24 that Shivambu's reasons for leaving are secret, but Business Day is reporting that MK Party has made a leadership offer to Shivambu, and a source has told the outlet that the party also expects other members who are sympathetic to MK to cross the floor and join Jacob Zuma's party. We also understand that a news briefing is expected to be held this hour. Let's try and get you some sense of what is or might be happening. From the Wits School of Governance, TK Puig, good afternoon to you and welcome. What's your sense of this? What do you think is happening?
Afternoon, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Well, look, I probably liken it to a bit of the situation between Tony Blair and the subsequent Prime Minister who followed him. I always keep forgetting his name. Gordon Brown, where eventually the number two wants to become number one. And there was always murmurs in the EFF that Floyd eventually wanted to see himself as the number one, so that he could basically get out of the shadow of Julius Malema. I think that's probably one. And the other is, look, and as well as usually post elections, there does need to be a sacrificial lamb. And I think the way the news was turning out regards to the VBS matter, I think Floyd looked like the likely sacrificial lamb, because number ones never sacrifice themselves. So I think it's probably two of those issues. But then again, there's always a third point, which is anything with the EFF is bound to probably come out later on when we really do know what happened.
So let's, we are still in the realms of conjecture as we speak. Nothing official yet, but I think it's pretty certain that he is going. If that is the case, what impact might his departure have on the EFF's internal dynamics and, I guess, its future direction?
Well, it's actually quite profound. There's always been an arrangement that Julius Malema is the political head of the EFF. He does the charismatic stuff. He goes out, he does the big blustering speeches. And Floyd was left to do the policy and some of the structural work within the EFF. With him leaving, it does really then raise questions about the institution of the EFF in terms of how do they reorganize themselves? Because Floyd was seen as probably the bright spark within the EFF as it relates to policy. Is it a question now that Julius Malema feels himself ready to be able to do two of those at the same time? But then there's also questions to say someone such as Floyd Shivambu would have natural, one might say, disciples who would probably follow him, as I think the news is saying, out of the EFF. And it will be interesting to see which of those figures follow Floyd out of the EFF and what positions do they come out of, because I think that's probably going to have another crippling effect on the EFF. So I think it is going to have a bit of an effect. We can't underplay him. I know most people do tend to veer towards the charisma of Mr. Julius Malema, but I think Mr. Floyd Shivambu should not be underestimated, especially his institutional capacity building within the EFF.
So let's assume the MK party has made some kind of leadership offer to Shivambu. What might this mean for the political landscape then?
Well, I think that might be quite huge. I'd liken it to almost like a football transfer. We don't have any of those anymore. We used to have floor crossing in South Africa, but we got rid of that. This would almost plug a gap for the MK, which is that institutional culture of parliament, which is to say they've not been great. I think they've had the numbers, but they've not been able to articulate their vision to really flow within parliament. And if there's one thing Mr. Shivambu has been known for, as I've just said, is institutional building. So that would probably be a very big coup for the MK party in terms of them having a structure and probably a line of order within parliament if you put him and the current leader of the official opposition, which is the former Judge Hlophe. But then it would be interesting to see how does that play out within the EFF, because it would almost mean that the EFF, how would they now treat the MK? Because if I'm not mistaken, they've got this progress. It's called an alliance within the parliament. It's a progressive caucus within parliament. So that probably would also create its own ructions and would probably mean that they turn more towards navel gazing instead of actually keeping an eye on the current grand coalition of South Africa.
TK, we do love a breaking news story on this podcast as we're having this conversation. My colleague Edward, our engineer, has just handed me a note saying that Floyd Shivambu confirming that he will not renew his membership. So it is a done deal. I'm interested to know if there are other young lieutenants within the EFF that might step into the vacuum.
Well, there's always hungry lions there. That's never the issue. But the question is that they got the capacity,
Well,
and
precisely.
it's a precarious situation because you fully understand that you are simply entering as a number two. Your aspirations of being number one are very curtailed. So it's a question of who's going to be there. I think names such as Mr. Ndlozi float around, but look, as I said, we are speculating. There's always been a close association between Mr. Floyd Shivambu and Mr. Ndlozi, so it'll be interesting to see whether he sticks around. There's a question of the current secretary of the EFF, Mr. Marshall, who's a close ally of Mr. Julius Malema. Would he be then allowed to step up into that position? And then maybe it could also be the situation that if you want to consolidate your position fully as a number one, you really do get somebody who is not that well known, who's not going to be a threat to you, but is going to occupy that position to make sure that you're never outflanked. And we do know Mr. Malema is quite the political player, and he might probably just go for somebody we have not really looked at that much.
And just quickly, Jacob Zuma is possibly sitting in a rocking chair, overlooking hills in Nkandla with a big smile on his face.
What do they say? Revenge is a dish best served cold.
Best
I think
served
that's
cold. That's right.
so. In this analogy, it would be it's a dish best served best. It's cold meat in Nkandla and with your traditional sorghum beer. So maybe Mr. Zuma might say, "Listen, I've already heard the current president, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa. Let me just not forget that individual named Julius Malema, and that is basically his. Like I said, he literally has changed the South African landscape. If Mr. Shivambu were to join, I would say, look, he's really reconstituted." Not only South Africa's parliament, but South Africa's political future going into the next 10 years.
And let's not forget that 24 hours is also a long time in politics in this country. 24 minutes is a long time in politics. From the Wits School of Governance, TK Puer, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's both disturbing and it did, I think, take analysts by surprise. South Africa's economy is simply not creating jobs fast enough to absorb people entering the market. And we now have a new high unemployment rate, 8.4 million people. Nkosi Nathi Mahlangu is portfolio head of youth development at Momentum and joins me on the program now on Impact. And firstly, the unemployment rate for young people, that cohort between 15 and 24, is alarmingly high, almost 61%. What do you think the immediate and long-term implications are?
Yes, so thank you so much, Jeremy. Looking at the stats and reflecting on the 15 to 24 cohort, that's where most of our graduates come from, and it makes you wonder in terms of the skills matching the job opportunities that are available out there. And then on the other side of the coin, we also realize that we still have young people not in education, not in employment, and not in training, which fall deeply into that bracket whereby there aren't any interventions that are helping young people to be rescued, to get the necessary skills and access even those entry-level jobs. So I think there is a skills mismatch, and we also need to audit in terms of what sectors are ready to absorb young people, especially in those categories and then have strategies and processes in place to address that immediately.
All right, good point. Let's talk about that skills mismatch, particularly as far as graduates are concerned. Are you suggesting that we're simply teaching the wrong things?
We may not be necessarily teaching the wrong things. However, I think there's a gap in terms of now getting the graduates to transition into the world of work. Because now once you graduated, one thing that becomes an obstacle is that workplace experience. So I think there's something fundamentally wrong in terms of how can we tailor the system to give that much needed workplace experience for learners while they're still at tertiary level so that they could transition into the world of work, which is where now we need to match the skills with the relevant courses that young people are embarking on. And the partnership between now the employing partners, whether it's the public or the private sector, to work closely with the tertiary institutions, be it TVETs or universities, just to have a streamlined way to get young people to have those workplace, to have their imaginary workplace experience, that could also help to solve this problem.
What's it going to take to retailer that system, as you suggest?
It would take, number one, commitment, because we all know that youth unemployment is at its ultimate high, and we all seem to be committed and saying the right things. But however, we're not doing the right things in terms of putting our efforts together, collaborating strategically to say who plays which role, so that we can have one coordinated way to say this is the pathway, this is the our north in terms of getting young people into employment. How do we make sure that we transfer skills into jobs, and also looking in terms of the critical skills that we usually import into the country? How critical are they to even not have South Africans maybe, you know, tapping into those opportunities? So we need to make sure that we audit adequately in terms of the skills that we import and look at the resources and the skills that we have in the country to match those gaps. So I think a coordinated, collaborative way is the way to go in this circumstances.
You make absolute sense, but the country, the economy, is in many ways caught between a rock and a hard place, because there is subdued business confidence, there's a continual focus on cost cutting rather than expansion, and that is going to preclude businesses from investing in creating job opportunity or job enablement for young people.
Definitely true, Jeremy. And with business as well, you know, applying the long-term lens to say, if young people continue to remain unemployed, how sustainable our businesses, or how sustainable business would be, because we don't have new entrants into the job market who will you know, subsequently become the clients to the various businesses that are out there. However, on the other hand as well, we also need to get the, you know, to work closer with business to understand what does business need in order for business to meet us halfway, to say we can create a pathway for entry-level jobs without even disrupting the business of the day, so to speak. However, government needs to play a very, very critical role in creating that enabling environment. And, you know, it's quite interesting that we come from the back of the elections, where even political parties, various political parties, had manifestos, plans to say, this is how we're going to create jobs. Now that we have a GNU, it's time to put those plans into action and see if we are really committed as South Africans to make our country work.
And are you confident that we're going to make that happen? Because if these unemployment numbers rise, particularly in that sector, this country is in deep trouble.
Very much so. It is a worrisome statistics, and we need to keep this conversation at the top of our agenda list, because we only have a reactive way to say, the stats are out, what do we do? And then come Youth Month in June, that's when we realize that young people are on the back foot. But however, if we can make this a national priority, in as much as, you know, whenever there's an outbreak, whenever there's a pandemic, this is another, you know, crisis that is facing our country. And if we're not acting soon enough, we'll find ourselves in a much, much deeper situation that will be difficult to come out of.
Nkosinathi Mahlangu, Portfolio Head of Youth Employment at Momentum. Thank you very much indeed for those insights.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The World Health Organization has declared the Mpox outbreak in parts of Africa a public health emergency. We'll get to that story in just a moment. But before that, this week, President Ramaphosa meeting with members of Business for South Africa, the collective of organizations working with government. So where are the new priorities? And I'm wondering if there's a new sense of thinking, a new sense of energy. Martin Kingston is with Business for South Africa and joins me now. And what's emerged?
So I would say there were two, Jeremy. The first is that there is an acknowledgement that we have put in place the structures, the systems, the resources, but that we need to be more disciplined about where there are challenges and address them. So specifically in the case of structural reform, and also, for example, in the case of the operational efficiency of Transnet. And then secondly, the scope to expand the scope of the partnership beyond the three focal areas of energy, transport and logistics, and crime and corruption to other areas. And there were areas that were mentioned, such as water, infrastructure, inner cities and municipalities. And the view was that although there might well be a good case to be made for extending the scope, we couldn't do that at the cost of the focus on the three current partnerships. There are huge resource constraints, as we know, on both sides of the table. And unless and until such time as we can satisfy ourselves that we've got the capacity to drive those, we won't extend the remit further.
As far as those three pillars are concerned, how do you start spinning the flywheel now?
And we've already seen, real progress in the case of energy, a very substantial reduction in load shedding, 140 days and counting. A lot of new generation already put into the system through the private sector, over 6 gigawatts, twice as much as that in place. But if we talk about energy for the moment, although structural reform has been put in place, there are some major challenges that we need to deal with going forwards. The transmission grid needing to be expanded, market reforms to be implemented, ensuring that we can reform the electricity distribution industry, in particular the competitiveness of the tariff. And then finally, of course, whether or not and how we deal with the issue of municipalities. So there is a particular focus area. The same thing in the case of transport and Transnet in particular, where frankly, it's underperforming very significantly in the current year. It's not going to meet its own budgets, let alone the levels that are required to support sort of economic recovery. And there is the question of actually mobilizing the resources, the skills and the expertise to address operational efficiencies, to deal with bottlenecks, to make sure that we've got a much more effective level of collaboration, including using the National Logistics Crisis Committee to oversee that. And obviously, and Jeremy, you and I have discussed this before, in both areas, addressing the maintenance backlog on both infrastructure and equipment. So there we think that we can tighten the focus. There's a lot of resource that's been mobilized, over 350 subject matter experts from business that has been deployed into these three areas. And then I'm sure you'll want to touch on crime and corruption. We also need to look at how we can be, more laser focused on a couple of areas, one of which, of course, is getting us off the grey listing with the Financial Action Task Force. Without that, we're not going to be able to both improve our cost of capital, but demonstrate that we can bring the perpetrators of crime to book in an efficient way. And capacitating the NPA there, again, particularly with sort of forensic capability that they don't currently have.
Has the dynamic within these discussions changed now that there is a government of national unity in place?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Actually, I think that the dynamic had already changed. This is a 12-month-old partnership in the current form. You'll recall that B4SA was established as a platform to partner with the government in the context of the pandemic. But in these economic interventions, it's 12 months and counting. And there'd already been, I think, a recognition and an acknowledgement that we were getting traction by virtue of working together, business supporting government. The GNU, I think, gives us an even better chance. There's a higher level of, energy, enthusiasm. We can see that positivity and confidence coming through in the markets, obviously, and a recognition that now there needs to be a broad consensus as to what are the keys of economic drivers. And if we look at the statement of intent, none of that is controversial. I mean, business supports all of the principles that underpin the statement of intent. And this was the first meeting, as you correctly identify, with the GNU under the auspices of the GNU in the context of the 7th administration, albeit building on the 6th administration. There's not a single minister in the room, and there were sort of over 10, that hasn't publicly previously indicated that there is a scope for partnering with the private sector and collaboration in an appropriately regulated manner. And that was reiterated both by government, as well as, I have to say, by business at the meeting the day before yesterday.
At what point do you think, Martin Kingston, are we going to see measurable impact that will have a direct influence on economic growth?
Yeah, well, we're seeing it already with energy, to be honest. I mean, I think that the curtailment of load shedding, and, you know, we keep our fingers crossed that's sort of, if not permanent, it's going to be the hallmark of behavior going forwards now, is one such example. We know that if we don't deal with transport and logistics, energy and crime and corruption, we constrain GDP growth by, you know, between 2 and 3% at least on an annualized basis. And obviously the converse to that is equally true. I think that we have already begun to see progress, but we need to manage expectations. It's going to take, I think, 6 to 12 months to get real runs on the board in terms of Transnet. It was a subject matter of real discussion, its underperformance, and how we can address that in the short term. One of the ministers reminded us that actually when we were talking about load shedding not being eradicated until the end of 2025, when we discussed that over the last 12 months, they said that was unacceptable. And indeed, we have turned the corner there, and that the same discipline needs to be brought to bear with Transnet and in some of the other areas. All of this requires, I have to say, significant leverage of resources. Resources requires funding, not just from the private sector, but from the public sector as well. That also was a significant area of focus. How do we capacitate these work streams? How do we ensure that we've got the right skills, capabilities and experience in place to be able to drive these both structural reforms, but also operational efficiencies going forwards? And that's going to be a primary and priority focus of our attention in the weeks ahead.
Martin Kingston, thank you very much as always.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The World Health Organization has declared the Mpox outbreak in parts of Africa a public health emergency of what it terms international concern. The highly contagious disease, formerly known as monkeypox, has killed at least 450 people during an initial outbreak in the DRC. Foster Mahali is the spokesperson for the National Department of Health and joins me on the program now. And first of all, then, what is the department's immediate reaction to this new declaration?
Yeah, no, thanks for this opportunity. Yes, as the department, we would like to welcome the declarations by both the CDC Africa and the World Health Organization declaring Mpox as a public health emergency of both continental and international concern. So, as you know, that in the country we've been responding well to the outbreak of this infectious but preventable disease. So, we can safely say for now the situation remains under control, even though now the declaration simply means now the response to this disease become collective responsibility for all the countries. So we have to show the solidarity with other countries, see how to share the resources, the data, the information, and also the successes and the practices which have worked for us as a country to put this under control.
So how is South Africa's approach in this respect going to change then?
Look, for now, as you know, that the main issue here was the shortage of vaccine and treatment, of which, as the country, we managed to make a breakthrough through the support of the World Health Organization country office. Although the treatment is limited, but so far it has assisted us a lot for now, based on the numbers of cases that we've been dealing with, but also based on the kind of variant or strain that we've been dealing with. As you know, that the variant that we are dealing with in the country is different from the variant that they are dealing with in countries like your DRC. So far, the situation is under control, but we want to continue to urge South Africans to say there's no need for public to panic, but we need to ensure that we remain vigilant at all times.
Just in terms of cross-border sharing of data, how difficult is that going to be?
Yeah, no, this it has, you remember during the time of cholera in the country and also the neighboring countries where at SADC, they called an urgent meeting of health ministers. then it was agreed that there's a need to share data so that we understand the burden of disease from our neighboring countries and also be able to intensify our response measures, but also to assist each other. Hence, in the country, the government, we are working closely with our border management authority, which is responsible for guarding our borders, to ensure that all people who are entering the country, especially those who are coming from countries which are battling the outbreak of this infectious disease, they get screened as they enter the country. Those who display the symptoms of mpox, they get referred to the nearest healthcare facility for further clinical evaluation.
Are you confident that the BMA is up to the task, or does it need more resources and more capacity?
Look, for now, we are very confident with the good work that they've been doing, but we still feel that because now we get reports of new variants in other parts of the world, we need to up the game, we need to work with them, we need to ensure that we intensify public education, because public is through public education that we can be able to contribute to stop the further transmission of this infectious disease, despite the fact that vaccine treatment are equally important, but the way we conduct ourselves will be able to contribute to how we manage to respond to this infectious disease.
What is the Department of Health's expectation of the World Health Organization?
Our expectation is that as they announce about the World Health Organization, that we need them to take a lead to ensure that they support the countries which are battling with this infectious disease through the resources like your funds, through the experts to assist with surveillance, through laboratories, because of course the only way we can be able to understand the burden of the disease is through testing, screening and the surveillance activities. So we need that, but also to ensure that there's equal access to life-saving vaccine. As we have learned during the time of COVID, that most of people who suffered the most are for those who are coming from the poor countries. As the rich countries, they conducted what we call vaccine hoarding. They bought almost all the vaccines, which made it impossible for poor countries, especially on the African continent, to access this life-saving vaccine. So we need to ensure that there's equal access to vaccine so that we are able to work as a collective, as the continent, as the global community, to fight the spread of this disease.
And in that respect, what pressure is the department putting on the World Health Organization?
As I indicated, that the Department of Health, we have got good working relations with the World Health Organization country office. Hence, they are the ones who assisted us with the current mpox-specific treatment that we have managed to secure limited stock, but they've done a lot of work. We wish that the same support that they're providing to South Africa can be supported to other countries which are battling the outbreak of this disease, because we are living in a global community.
And I am going to leave it there. From the Department of Health, Foster Mahali, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let me stay with health matters now, and the cost of staying healthy is getting a whole lot more difficult. Medical aid contributions have skyrocketed over the past couple of years at the rate of double inflation, and the industry is now warning that members should expect more of the same for next year. Mondi Kuvozela is Senior Manager, Benefits Management, Council for Medical Schemes. He joins us now. And first of all, I guess it's the obvious question. Why have medical aid contributions consistently risen at rates double that of inflation?
I agree with you. For the longest of time, a lot of research has been published regarding the unsustainable contribution increases. We have seen in the last 20 years, contributions being at least 4 to 6% above a CPI. This is clearly unsustainable, and we see this as a threat to the sustainability of our medical schemes. But the question that we are asking is, what causes this? In our view, it is the way the medical schemes industry is organized. There's a fragmentation of risk pools. You have 71 medical schemes that are registered with the Council for Medical Schemes. They offer 250 benefit options. What that does is that there is a weak risk pooling. It means you have instances where there are options with very few beneficiaries. Some options have as low as numbers as low as less than 100, you know, a beneficiaries in an option. And in terms of the law, these options should be self-sustaining. And for them to sustain themselves, clearly the only thing that Medicaid schemes should do year on year is to increase contribution at rates above inflation. We've also observed that members of Medicaid schemes are growing older, and with age, what follows is chronic diseases and a need for more healthcare. So the healthcare utilization increases with age. The problem is that you then have this increased contribution increases that then serve as a disincentive for new entrants, young and healthy entrants, that should then cross-subsidize the older and sick members. So you're not getting new members coming into the environment.
Let me interrupt you and ask you if there are any realistic strategies or new models that can be implemented to bring down the costs.
The strategy that should be adopted, we're looking at a reduction of the number of medical schemes. That's the only way that you then increase the purchasing power of medical schemes. We're looking at medical schemes adopting more, you know, strategic purchasing approaches. Medical schemes should not just be a price takers. They must identify networks that provide the best health outcome for members, that prevent hospitalization, that provide the care that is needed by members at the time that is needed. So there's a lot of wastage in the system. There's a weak control of utilization. So yes, there is a way that this can be controlled.
And when you put ideas like that on the table, are the schemes listening to you or are they fighting back?
You see, the biggest problem that the schemes do support consolidation, but they think that it should happen at the pace that the market dictates that it happens. On the side of the council, we cannot force it because there's no provision in the Act that allows to force medical schemes to merge to create a larger risk pool. The medical schemes, there's no law that allows us to force them to purchase healthcare in a more efficient fashion. For instance, medical schemes use fee for service as a manner of purchasing healthcare from our service providers. Fee for service internationally is known to increase the cost unnecessarily because the risk sits with the scheme and the provider can provide as much service even though it's not needed. So schemes do have control over these mechanisms. We have seen at least one amalgamation or mergers annually. We think that we should see more so that you've got bigger risk pools.
But that's hardly likely to happen given that they are acting often in the best interests of their shareholders.
I have heard the argument about shareholders. You see, medical schemes are not for-profit entities. They are owned by members. In my introduction, it was important that I mentioned that members will constitute 50% of our board of trustees. But there is this belief that medical schemes are insurance companies and therefore make profits. They don't make profits. They are to make surpluses. If there are surpluses, they should be used to improve or cushion contribution increases. You are correct that there's an element of profit here, but the element of profit is on other entities that, you know, work with medical schemes. Entities such as managed care organizations, such as administrators, which are allowed to make profit.
All right. So if you're suggesting that the solution here is for more consolidation to increase purchasing power, you have no way of influencing this as the council. Where does the pressure need to come from?
The pressure should come from members. Members should participate in the decision-making of medical schemes. It makes sense that if an option, some options have an average age of 50, there is no way that it can be sustainable. They have no choice in any case. At some stage, they'll be forced to merge, but at the time, the merger will not be ideal to members because some of them might not even be able to afford a cover in an merging scheme, or they might fall off the scheme that they're in, which will collapse. We've seen collapses that are due to the fact that medical schemes can no longer afford to pay for benefits, looking at the contribution that they receive.
All right. Mondi Govozela, I'm going to leave it there. Unfortunately, we are out of time. It's a serious issue, but thank you for shedding some light on it. I do appreciate it. On our last online poll, just as I bid you farewell, Johannesburg's mayor quits. I asked you if things are going to change, if it's going to be more musical chairs or stand by for more municipal chaos. And most of you thought the orchestra is going to continue to play. Today, government and business talking up cooperation. Are you confident? Do you think this is hot air or are you waiting to see what happens? If you have a view on that, please share it with us either on LinkedIn or on X. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.